What are the facts concerning the crimes allegedly committed by Canadian and former child soldier Omar Khadr? What does the decade-long detention of Khadr at the Guantanamo Bay prison facility say about the state of human rights and justice in Canada? Is there a defense of the Canadian government's neglecting to advocate for Khadr? Is there an explanation for the way the Canadian government, intelligence, and other authorities refrain from criticizing Guantanamo Bay? Have the attitudes of ordinary Canadians hardened against Khadr? And if so, why? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we probe the circumstances surrounding the arrest and lengthy detention by U.S. authorities of Canadian Omar Khadr with his legal representative. On today's program, The Case of Omar Khadr, a conversation with Dennis Edney. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 26th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We are also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. What is not mentioned in the media reports is that the heads of state and heads of government who have endorsed America's campaign against the Islamic State, advised by their respective secret services, are fully aware that U.S. intelligence is the unspoken architect of the Islamic State, which is part of a vast network of U.S.-supported jihadist terrorist entities. Lest we forget, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, have been financing and training the ISIL terrorists on behalf of the United States. Israel is harboring the Islamic State, ISIL, in the Golan Heights. NATO, in liaison with the Turkish High Command, has since March 2011 been involved in coordinating the recruitment of the jihadist fighters dispatched to Syria. Moreover, the ISIL brigades in both Syria and Iraq are integrated by Western special forces and military advisors. All this is known and documented, yet not a single head of state or head of government has had the courage to point to the absurdity of the U.S.-sponsored United Nations Security Council resolution, which was adopted unanimously on September 24th. What we are witnessing is a criminal undertaking under U.N. auspices. That comes from the article, "The Terrorists Are Us, the Islamic State, Big Lie," by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted September 25th. You, Mr. President, accused Russia of aggression, arming the rebels in Ukraine, even though Russia has done its utmost to find a political solution and now there is a ceasefire on the ground. On the other hand, the U.S. and its democratic moderate allies, namely Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, UAE, Bahrain, all of which are oppressive medieval kingdoms, have created a vast global network of Islamist fanatics and zealots. Worse, they have been made to imbibe the most violent, extremist, and intolerant versions of Islam, essentially of the Wahhabi Salafist schools. The world is aware of the fact that from the ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda of Syria, to the so-called moderate FSA, Free Syrian Army, all of these terrorist organizations have been mobilized, provided safe havens for training from Western sources. On these facts, the majority of the world is aware, the reason being that you have been using the same strategy for far too long. That comes from the article, "The Lies and Deceit of President Barack Obama," by Feroz Mithiborhawala, posted September 25th, originally posted at Medhaj News. A recent study published in PLOS titled difficulties in eliminating measles and controlling rubella and mumps, a cross-sectional study of a first measles and rubella vaccination and a second measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination, has brought to light the glaring ineffectiveness of two measles vaccines, measles rubella, MR, or measles mumps rubella, MMR, in fulfilling their widely claimed promise of preventing outbreaks in highly vaccine-compliant populations. In the new study, researchers analyzed a subset of 1,015 Zhejiang inhabitants and found that despite the recent measles outbreaks, 93.6% of them were seropositive for measles antibodies, meaning they had presumably vaccine-induced protective antibodies against measles in their blood serum, more than is required to obtain so-called herd immunity threshold of 88% to 92%, which is often claimed to be the solution to extinguishing infectious diseases altogether. And yet, despite this theoretical protection, 8.6% of the subjects developed measles anyway. And of course, we cannot leave out mention of what is likely the greatest medical cover-up of our time. The senior vaccine scientist William Thompson at the CDC blows the whistle on how his agency covered up the autism vaccine link for over a decade, and likely much more malfeasance still to be uncovered, and which is still ongoing, as no mainstream media group has yet to cover the facts of the story in a serious or honest manner. How many of these Chinese infants and children will undergo neurodevelopmental regression or suffer other neurological insults as a result of using the same MMR vaccine the CDC identified as doing harm to African-American boys? That comes from the article, "Why is China Having Measles Outbreaks When 99% Are Vaccinated?" by Sayer G., posted September 24th, originally appearing in Green Med Info. Iraqi officials say that the United States is due to send 13,000 soldiers to Iraq, despite its claims of complete military withdrawal from the country. The vice president of the local council of Iraq's Saladin province made the announcement on Thursday, adding that the troops, along with their vehicles, would be stationed at the Spiker airfield in the city of Tikrit, located 140 kilometers or 87 miles northwest of the capital Baghdad. The deployment comes as U.S. President Barack Obama said earlier this month that he would not pursue another ground war in Iraq after U.S. troops pull out from the country in 2011. Senior religious and political figures in Iraq, including Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, have in recent days called on the Baghdad government not to rely on foreign powers in the battle against the ISIL. Political experts believe that the real objective of the so-called international coalition recently formed by Washington to fight ISIL is to expand the U.S. military presence in the region. That comes from the article, 13,000 U.S. troops to be deployed to Iraq, officials by Press TV, posted September 25th. Internationally recognized economist Roderick Tremblay once said, quote, "The world should be worried about those who go around the planet with a can of gasoline in one hand and a box of matches in the other, pretending to be selling fire insurance. The empire of chaos and its coalition of terrorism financiers are selling fictitious security covers to the people of the Middle East by bombing their own colonies of terror and violence in Syria. Stopping terrorism requires not participating in it," Tremblay stressed. "Washington's campaign is madness. Iraqis and Syrians alone can defeat the American caliphate and rid its medieval violent ideology from their territories." That comes from the article, "Reactions to Obama's Naked Aggression Against Syria," by Stephen Lendman, posted September 24th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Omar Khadr is a Canadian born of Egyptian and Palestinian parents. As a child, he'd moved to Jalalabad, Afghanistan with his family. He was 15 when the 9/11 attacks happened. 10 months later, he was captured following a battle with U.S. forces in the village of Ayub Kail, Afghanistan. Khadr, injured during the melee, was accused of throwing a hand grenade and planting bombs targeting U.S. troops. In October, Khadr was transferred to Guantanamo Bay, suspected of being an enemy combatant. He would reside at that facility for a decade before being released based on a plea bargain. Khadr is believed to have been subjected to extreme interrogation techniques during his capture. The boy spent an entire decade at Guantanamo. In 2010, he entered a guilty plea on the advice of his lawyer, Dennis Edney, in order for him to win release from the notorious American prison. Miscarriages of justice are being highlighted. Arising out of Khadr's detention were questions surrounding the detention of adults and the treatment of child soldiers. In 2010, Khadr entered his plea bargain. It was another 2 years before Khadr was returned to Canada. Upon arrival, he was placed at Millhaven Maximum Security Penitentiary. He currently resides at the Edmonton Maximum Security Prison. Khadr's lawyer is Dennis Edney. Edney has taken on the Khadr case pro bono and has been involved since 2003, representing his client at the Supreme Court of Canada and at the United States Supreme Court. Dennis Edney is recipient of the 2008 National Pro Bono Award and of the 2009 Human Rights Medal, awarded by the Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia for work that, quote, has helped to promote and further human rights. The Global Research News Hour contacted Edney during his visit to Winnipeg, Canada, on the occasion of the grand opening of that city's brand new Human Rights Museum. He gave a talk at the Grand Mosque Community Center in South Winnipeg. An excerpt of that talk is included into the interview you are about to hear. But first, we'll hear some comments from Robert Betty, the key organizer of the Winnipeg tour, about his involvement with the Khadr case and what human rights defenders should do to help.
I'm a supporter of Omar Khadr. I'm a supporter of human rights in general. And I came to his case, or became aware of his case, when I first heard Dennis Edney speak to the citizens of Edmonton at an event organized by the students of the King's University College in Edmonton in 2008. And I heard Dennis speak. It was a compelling story about a 15-year-old Canadian who had been left high and dry by his government. And at the time, I was a parent of a 14 and a 16-year-old, so it resonated with me. And I chose to get involved, and I have been for 6 years, and it's been a very compelling and rewarding journey. I saw this case as a shocking revelation that the country that I grew up in maybe wasn't the same country I was living in today, and that maybe I needed to open my eyes a little bit to the status of human rights and the things that I presumed were there for my children and would be there for my grandchildren in terms of rule of law and human rights that I took for granted as a young person. Maybe as a 50-something man, I need to stand up for and speak out about.
Speak directly to the listeners. You know, I've heard the sad facts and some of the uplifting possibilities. What can they do to, even in general terms, to advance this cause?
I'd say two or three things. First of all, don't take your human rights for granted. Speak out, stand up, get involved, write letters to the editor, write letters to your MP, become an active participant in your society, because if you don't speak up and it changes, you can't really blame anyone else but yourself if it changes in a way that you're not content with. In terms of the specifics of the Omar Khadr case, if someone is inspired like I was to take on this particular case, there's both opportunities for physical support and financial support. And the way I would encourage people to seek that out is through a website called Free Omar Khadr Now, which has a PayPal click button for financial support, or put Omar Khadr into Facebook, and there's three or four active Facebook groups where you'll hear about upcoming events in your community and that sort of thing, where you can become more involved to learn more and also to exercise your voice in human rights.
Robert Betty, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're joined right now in the studio by Dennis Edney. He is the defense attorney for Omar Khadr. Dennis Edney has been working as Mr. Khadr's legal counsel on a pro bono basis, and continues to champion his fight. Dennis, you've been spending some time here in Winnipeg telling us a little bit about the fight for justice for Omar Khadr. Could you maybe fill in a little bit of the details about how you personally came to be drawn to this particular cause?
Well, I'm not sure what came first. I was approached by the Center for Constitutional Law of New York to consider doing a joint application before the U.S. Supreme Court seeking habeas rights for all detainees in Guantanamo Bay. The center was looking for a Canadian lawyer to bring a Canadian perspective before the Supreme Court in the case of Rasool versus Bush. My facts are sometimes, I'm very bad at dates and times, and so you have to I apologize if I make any errors. At some point in time, I had thought that I was representing a other Canadian. There was another Canadian in Guantanamo Bay, and we were never given his name. And then he disappeared off the record. And in fact, over the early years of going to Guantanamo with my co-counsel, Nate Whitling, we would try to make inquiries about the other Canadian, and nothing ever transpired of that. About that, a little anecdote on the side is that just a few years ago, I received a call from a U.S. news reporter who confirmed there was another Canadian in Guantanamo Bay, and he urgently wanted to speak with me, but what he said in the conversation was he would get back to me. And I never asked him what his name was, and so I heard nothing more. But at some point in time, we then approached the Omar Khadr family, asked them if they wished to have representation for Omar Khadr, and so that's when we started at advocating on behalf of Omar Khadr.
And you eventually met with Omar Khadr. He'd been there just about a year.
Omar Khadr was in Guantanamo in late 2002, and then a few years later, we were able to be allowed into Guantanamo and actually meet with Omar Khadr. We had continued to advocate on his behalf as his lawyers, because we obtained the legal approval from his family, from his grandparents, actually. And so we were advocating and dealing with the Canadian government about Omar Khadr. We were seeking all kinds of information about his status from the Canadian government. And so I built up quite a pen pal relationship with the Canadian government. But at the end of the day, they did not provide any information about Omar Khadr.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the way the legal gears turn, I mean, you know, as a lawyer, you have a certain kind of approach to take. I think, though, the rest of the country is kind of, you know, thinking in terms of what really happened, as opposed to what we're being told happened. Do you have any insights, or can you at least say with some confidence what did happen, and with confidence what did not happen?
Well, with confidence, what I could say is, at worst, Omar Khadr was a child soldier, at worst. And we, under international law, understand what that means. It means that children, youths, are put in a position beyond their control and end up becoming child soldiers. And therefore, we view them as victims. We don't view them as someone we should be punished. Rather, what we set about to do is to ensure that they get proper education and rehabilitate it from any indoctrinated viewpoints that they may have.
Okay. So regardless of what actually happened, the man does have certain rights under the law that have to be protected, and they weren't.
We all have rights under the law. Omar Khadr had, as a youth, had all types of international protections, which were not recognized by the United States. The United States did not recognize that international law had a place in Guantanamo. In fact, in the case of Rasul versus Bush, the United States government made the argument in 2004 that its own judicial system had no jurisdiction over what transpired in Guantanamo Bay.
There's two institutions here, at least, that have conspired to, irresponsibly assault Mr. Khadr's rights. There's the institution of the military tribunal and the institution of Guantanamo Bay itself, and just how all the legal safeguards just seem to...
Well, the other players, the Supreme Court of the United States agreed that the detainees in Guantanamo should get habeas rights, which essentially means that they are entitled to know the case against them and challenge it in a properly constituted court of law. So they agreed that we were correct. And I remember that day, when we left the Supreme Court, we were all drinking champagne and thinking we had it made, we'd done it. And we had a good hearing. And we did have a good hearing. But the Bush administration then bypassed the Supreme Court by coming out with the Military Commission Act, which then created some quasi-habeas process that was later turned down in the case of Hamden. I point that out because the other player that didn't come to the table was Canada. Any government who signs on to international treaties is required to advocate for its own citizens should that citizen be in another country and being arrested. Mm. And so the Consular Relations Act, for example, which is probably, in my view, one of the most primary important international instruments, was not allowed, afforded to Omar Khadr, which means that no consular visits, no one could go in to see Guantanamo, see Omar from Canada and provide him legal and other assistance. And Canada didn't object to that. Omar Khadr was not provided protection as a child under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the most signed on international covenant that other than Somalia and United States are the only two who had not ratified that. And so that gives basic fundamental protection to Omar, in particular that he should not be in a prison with adults. Mm-hmm. And Canada didn't advocate for that. And then later, of course, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that Canada had participated in torturing Omar along with the United States. And so the Convention Against Torture, which is probably one of the more fundamental international instruments dealing with human rights, that was violated both by the United States and by Canada, and the Canadian government did nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just as a lawyer has an obligation, you know, you accept your client, someone as a client, you have an obligation to represent to the best of your ability. Likewise, the government, whether you like, I mean, you could be a lawyer and not like your client, but you have obligations to him. Mr. Harper may, whether he likes Omar or not, whatever he might think, doesn't matter. The government has an obligation to represent him, to advocate on his behalf.
And it was it was both under the Liberal watch and under the Conservative watch. Under the Liberal watch, Foreign Affairs Minister Graham was interviewed. He was asked that particular question, how come he didn't advocate properly or fully or assiduously for Omar Khadr? And he commented that he was being told by the Americans that Khadr was being treated well and that he trusted their opinion because they were renowned for their human rights, the U.S. government. And I recall that statement being made in New York and showing a documentary, You Don't Wish to Know the Truth, where he's interviewed Mr. Graham, and the whole American audience started laughing at that. And then it followed, and of course, and then we had the Deputy Prime Minister, Anne McLellan, who said that...
Liberal Prime Minister at the time,
yeah. Deputy Prime Minister... who made comments that such as the Americans know what they're doing, let's just leave them alone. Mm. And then, of course, we then moved into a new prime minister who has continued being intransigent about recognizing human rights for Omar Khadr.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the facility itself, where you did eventually go to visit Omar. I'm curious about the Guantanamo Bay facility, and because all of us have our own preconceptions, and I'm sure you did as well. Was there anything about it that really struck you as you entered the grounds about to meet with Mr. Omar?
There's a variety of Guantanamos. There's Guantanamo proper, it's a little town, small little town. It has fast food restaurants, there's a football field, there's a bowling alley, and it's where there's a lot of military camps there. And it also has a number of high-rise buildings for guests, etc. And then close to the town, there is a courthouse, and that courthouse is where the so-called trial of Omar Khadr took place. And then there are other areas that no one is permitted to visit without a high level of security clearance. And one area is the cages that we've all witnessed on various media outlets. And then when you drive past those cages, there is another area where there are two secret prisons. Camp 5 and Camp 6 is called. And there's a third secret prison, but I never was able to locate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in those two secret prisons, Camp 5 and Camp 6, Omar Khadr spent a great deal of time in solitary confinement in both of those prisons, both before trial and post-trial. After trial, having been convicted, Omar Khadr then was taken from the cages and put back into one of those secret prisons that are designed for torture or enhanced interrogation techniques, as the Pentagon would tell us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. So when you met Omar face-to-face, was the first thing to hit you about his the way he looked, the way he presented, the way he spoke?
I saw someone who was seriously injured, locked away in a cold, solitary cell that had no windows. I've often described him as a broken bird, and I do that because I like watching birds. I have all kinds of bird books. And I saw Omar Carrot as a young kid. He seemed to be using his arms to keep himself warm. And he had all kinds of injuries. He was blind in one eye, had problems with his remaining good eye. He had paralysis in one of his shoulders, and he has all kinds of scars on his body. He has terrible scars on his body. He has holes in the back of his back, and he was suffering from all types of shrapnel wounds. But what I was not aware of at that time was that he had been regularly abused and tortured over a number of years prior to my visit. So it's understandable how forlorn and dejected and lonely and unhappy and pained that young man was. And it stunned me. It stuns me today when I recreate my first image of Omar Carrot.
I recall the first time I met him in Guantanamo. I'd arrived there excited that I was one of the very few civilian lawyers to be allowed into Guantanamo Bay. My ego was really engaged. And on arrival, I was spirited away to a security cleared zone where I had to satisfy various security protocols, from obtaining different levels of security clearance to listening to several lectures from intelligence officers informing me that I would be meeting some of the most sophisticated and dangerous people on earth, and that it was in my best interest at all times to be accompanied by security personnel. And any communications between my client and I could not be shared with the outside world without proper approval or face 30 years in prison. So to help me deal with my client and protect me from being the worst of the worst, all conversations between myself and my client were taped, videotaped, and any notes were taken away from me to be reviewed and never to be returned. I was also made to understand that my freedom to leave Guantanamo was contingent each and every time on complying with those safety security protocols. And then several hours later, I stepped out into the deadly silence of Guantanamo. You can hear a pin drop in Guantanamo. And I had thought then that I would finally be meeting Omar in the cages that had been so publicized by the media. Instead, I was taken to one of the more high security areas of Guantanamo, where there are three secret prisons, Camp 5, Camp 6, and Camp 7. Although you're not allowed to mention 7 at any time. And these are prisons that the Pentagon has described designed for enhanced interrogation procedures. And that's just simply obvious code for torture. And I recall in some of the very few documents I was able to obtain as part of disclosure for Omar's trial, reading an intelligence excerpt from an FBI officer describing his experience in visiting Guantanamo Bay. And this is what he said. On a couple of occasions, I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained hand and foot in a fetal position to the floor, with no chair, food, or water. Most times, they urinated or defecated on themselves and had been there for 18 to 24 hours or more. On another occasion, the conditioner had been turned off, making the temperature in the unventilated room well over 100 degrees. The detainee was almost unconscious on the floor with a pile of hair next to him. He'd apparently been literally pulling his hair out and throughout the night. The FBI initially went out to Guantanamo Bay, and they refused to become complicit in the abuses that took place there, and they stopped going. And so I do recall my first meeting with Omar in a windowless concrete cell, and he was 17 at the time. He was sitting there, was the tragic figure of Omar, shackled to the floor, blind in one eye, difficulties with his remaining good eye, partially paralyzed on his right side, with his whole body suffering from extensive shrapnel injuries. And he shivered all the time. His cell was also purposely kept cold, so requiring Omar to spend much of his time trying to stay warm, making the best use of the blanket and the mattress pad when they hadn't been confiscated. And it was on entering his cell, I was then informed by the guards that Omar had withdrawn into himself and hadn't spoken to anyone for months. And here before me was this most forlorn, tragic, and lonely figure of a 17-year-old young boy who hadn't spoken to anyone for months. And I was a father, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I recall involuntary gasping at the sight of him, and I had much difficulty in controlling my emotions. I wanted to cry. I wanted to scream. I just wanted to do something. I had not been prepared for what I was witnessing. And as I said, I was a father. I had young children. And I knew that my children were home in comfort and safety, secure with their mother. And that first image of Omar Carter haunted me for years, this young, forlorn, dejected, tragic figure. And so I spent the next, I was there for 3 days, and I spent the next few days attempting unsuccessfully to engage him in conversation. I talked, and I talked, and I talked. I talked about my family, describing the beauty of Canada, my love of the mountains, and all to no avail. And finally, out of desperation, just using up time because I thought I've not been able to reach my client. And so I pulled out my wallet and showed photographs, those hockey photographs of my youngest boy, Duncan. And it was at that time that he picked the card and felt it, and we started to talk. So here was this young man struggling with a life of despair in a cell where normal light did not penetrate, stripped of all possessions and devoid of human contact. Yet he chose then to put his trust in me and believe in my message of hope. But I also remember what he said when I was leaving the next day. He said, "You'll leave me. Everyone does." And all the while, both the Liberal government in power, followed by the Conservative government, persisted in telling the Canadian public that they had been assured that Omar was being treated humanely and would take the United States at its word, while the rest of the world heaped condemnation on Guantanamo Bay as an evil place. We are the only Western country, 5 minutes, we are the only Western country who has never condemned Guantanamo Bay. And every time I left after a visit with Omar, I was aware of the world that I was leaving him into.
What about the reactions of ordinary Canadians? I know that you've been talking, there were two presentations yesterday about, the government and state officials and what they are and are not doing. But what about the general public? Because I get a sense, and there have been like public opinion polls that show an alarming number of Canadians initially didn't want him coming back to Guantanamo, even though that was something that, was an obligation. So what does that say? Has there been a coarsening of our values, or are we being...
I think what happened was that the Carter family, the mother and the daughter, the oldest daughter, were interviewed by CBC. And in that documentary, they said ridiculous things. And that interview branded Omar Carter as being like his mother and sister because of their statements. And so the Canadian public had that to deal with, and they didn't read the story. When I hear people talking about Omar Khadr or challenging Omar Khadr, I realize that the vast majority who feel like that have not read the story of Omar Khadr. But I should also tell you that a number of years ago, through the Toronto Star, I think, that there was a poll taken, and it was about 50-50% of people either way. I would suggest to you that today it's probably far higher. Mm-hmm. In favor of Omar Khadr being released.
Mm-hmm. So, if something like this had happened, say in the 1980s, do you think that it would that the Canadian public would? It would, I mean, have our values changed that much since then, or is it just like as you're saying, the way his story has been shaped, branded?
Well, you must remember at the time, mm-hmm. we had George Bush coined the war on terror. We had witnessed the incredible sight of the Twin Towers collapsing, which created real fear in all of us. We had this unseen enemy. So there was a sense of paranoia, a sense of self-protection, a sense of hysteria in the minds of the public. And Guantanamo Bay then was set up to, as Dick Cheney said, to house the worst of the worst. And so in those early days, people bought into the fact that we were now taken quite properly off the streets, the most evil of individuals who wished to do damage to us, and locked them in a place away from us. And so we bought into that. And it's understandable to buy into that type of hysteria at an early stage. It was only as the years progressed and international bodies started inquiring about Guantanamo that particularly the Center for Constitutional Law of New York has been a preeminent advocate in demonstrating the horror of Guantanamo Bay. We had Lord Goldsmith out of Britain who described Guantanamo Bay as a legal black hole. And so that information was then coming before the Canadian public. But it was the war on terror and the politics of fear was working well and has worked well ever since.
So that basically the public was manipulated, but what about the manipulators or people in high places, specifically in Canada? We didn't allude to it in this conversation, but before you met with Omar, he met with Canadians who he thought were there to rescue them. But They saw his situation and essentially saw no evil. More than that, our intelligence services seemed to have an investment in keeping him there.
Well,
or at least in not speaking out against too strongly against what's happening.
Well, my experience in the area of terrorism, of represented terrorists, is that the government's main important priority, not only in protecting its people, need intelligence. And one of the primary providers of that intelligence is the United States. And so there was a type of Faustian bargain made by many democratic countries that you had to be on board with the Americans in order to share the intelligence that was going to protect you and your people. And the bargain was, you don't question places like Guantanamo Bay and what we're doing, because we, the United States, know what we're doing. And so we sold our souls to the war on terror.
That's a very important point you're raising, because it suggests that the neglect of a Canadian citizen goes beyond the character of a single man in high office, Prime Minister Harper, that there's somehow within the infrastructure of government these decisions are being made, which raises the question, like, who really is governing on behalf of the people and the Constitution?
Well, I was invited to a conference by the University of Alberta, and I was in a debate with Anne McClellan and a third party, and we were talking about security. And Anne McClellan, and former Deputy Prime Minister for the Liberals, essentially her position was, trust us, we know better. In fact, I think those are the exact words that she made. And I had, while she was Deputy Prime Minister, I had been seeking information about the treatment of Omar Khadr for over 5 years leading up to a Supreme Court of Canada decision that allowed me to get the information that I had been seeking. And so with that information and the help of some reporters who had interviewed Anne McClellan, I was able to demonstrate that you can't trust government. And Anne McClellan knew, or ought to have known, or was reckless or blind, one of the two, that she was well aware of information coming out of Guantanamo that was sent to Canada about how Omar was being mistreated. And so she lied. And our governments, as I say, sacrificed Omar Khadr on the altar of intelligence obtaining. Hmm. And I think that's all I can say.
Was the a mention during the panel discussion, this idea that of Omar being more than a man, he's a symbol. And that begs the question, I mean, a symbol for the government being used as a kind of a cudgel with which to fend off their various...
Well, he's certainly important to the government.
Mm.
Because they seemed to spend a lot of time on him.
They even forged some legislation, the dual citizen, amendment to the Citizenship Act, which essentially would propose to end the citizenship of somebody who attacks a Canadian, commits a crime against one of the Canadian armed forces.
Well, I was thinking more about the fact that recently, before Christmas, I was in a lower court than in the Court of Appeal, where we were arguing that Omar should be treated as a juvenile and a unanimous decision from the Court of Appeal of Alberta agreed with us. But on both of those two instances, before the lower court and before the Court of Appeal, each time our Prime Minister had a press conference solely directed to Omar Khadr to let the Canadian people know that he committed an alleged, they don't say that, a heinous crime, and he was a terrorist. Now, I would have thought that our leader, our Prime Minister, would understand that you don't interfere with the judiciary when you've got someone coming before the court, but that didn't bother him. And I would have thought that he had enough things on his mind to deal with in running the country without focusing on this 15-year-old boy. So obviously Omar Khadr, for various reasons that only I think the Prime Minister and his lackeys can describe or advise, is that Omar's important. And I give you another example. It's a common sense viewpoint of mine, is that what your listeners may not be aware is that Omar Khadr has never, ever been interviewed by a single media person. And he's not allowed that. Now, and I wish him to be released. I argue that he's not a bad guy. I argue, in fact, he's a wonderful guy. Now, but I'm now having to go to court to allow the media to interview Omar Khadr, which the government is challenging. So if they really believe that he is a bad person, not a nice person, he's a terrorist, etc., then why would they object to him being interviewed and let the world, particularly the Canadian people, hear Omar, see Omar, and make up their own mind? He would obviously, surely, the type of person, if he is the type of person that the government says he is, then the Canadian public will be able to make that determination. Mm. But they don't want that.
In fact, I mean, the Canadian public, it was the Canadian government and only the Canadian government on a political level essentially came and said, denied that privilege, right?
Sure. When he was in Millhaven, Colin Perkle, the Canadian press, was twice approved by the warden to interview Omar Khadr, and twice the Prime Minister's office struck his decision down, which is most unusual. A warden is giving the job of running a prison. He is the one who makes all types of determinations about how that prisoner should be treated and what levels of security he should be at, because who better knows the prisoner than the warden? And yet he was overturned by the Prime Minister's office.
I want you to as we're coming to a close, I want you to maybe give us a few hints about his actual character of the man. The guilty plea that some of his detractors will jump on, say, there, he admitted it. Where did the idea to plead guilty come? Did it come from him?
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. At some point after the trial had been interrupted by the collapse of the American military defense lawyer, and then when we reconstituted that trial again, just before the trial, an offer was made by the Americans. And my job was to sell it to Omar Khadr. And Omar Khadr did not wish to enter into the plea bargain. He did not wish to admit that he was a terrorist. And one of his concerns was that the Canadian public would now believe he was a terrorist as a result of entering into a plea bargain. And I was able to persuade Omar to take that plea bargain on the basis that he would be, if he didn't, he would remain forever in Guantanamo Bay. And I said to him, when you get to Canada, you can let the Canadian public know who you are. Which takes me, as we're running out of time, to who he is. You know, he is a gentleman. He is a compassionate man. He has no anger towards anybody. That he, as I've said many times, is like many other torture victims. That they seem to find a humanity somewhere inside themselves, and they have no anger towards anybody. I recall asking Omar Khadr in Guantanamo, what does he want to do once he gets out? And he said, I want to be a doctor. And I asked why. And he said, because I want to ensure that no one else is harmed like I've been harmed. And over the years, working with Omar Khadr, I find myself admiring him. It's a privilege to represent somebody of his humanistic character. He has no idealistic notions whatsoever. Every piece of document that we have from both sides of the fence attests to that. And so should the Canadian public ever get to see him or meet him, they will, I surely could tell you that they will see him as the way I do. An absolute credit to Canada.
Okay. Well, I could see that Mr. Omar Khadr has good representation in you. So thank you very much for sharing that those thoughts and concerns with the wider public. Dennis Edney.
And thank you for having me.
Okay. Speaking with Dennis Edney, he is Omar Khadr's legal representative. That was lawyer Dennis Edney speaking about the case of Omar Khadr and its significance to human rights and justice in Canada. People who wish to help Khadr can visit weareomarkhadr.com. That's weareomarkhadr.com. Or join the email listserv by emailing weareomarkhadr@gmail.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.